So we are in the middle of chapter one, and we started to get this aha moment, this epiphany, where one second, all of our struggles are because we have not one soul, but two. And it reminds us of the story from the Torah where Rivka Imenu, our matriarch, she comes to Ledresh Es Hashem to ask, inquire of Hashem. Why was she praying so much for pregnancy when she has all this squirming or kicking going on in her uterus? And when she finally gets the answer, it's, you know what? You have two nations in your womb. And then she feels better. I mean, did the kicking go away? Like, why are you feeling better now that you know that you have two nations in your womb? And really, it's because she was like, what kind of kid is this? Every time she goes by a place of holiness, the kid is kicking. And then every time she goes by a place of unholiness, the kid is kicking. She's like, I can't believe it. This kid is insane. She says, no, don't worry. It's not one kid. It's two nations, two separate beings in your womb. And suddenly she's calmed. And that's us. You know, this is actually what we were learning recently in the chapters that we were studying for Chitas, our daily study, in chapter 28, where the Altar said, you know, you can assume that there's a serious issue if while you're praying and then suddenly you have bad thoughts, if you only had one soul. It was the same soul that was praying, and it was the same soul that was conjuring up all these crazy thoughts. But it's not one soul, it's two souls. And the fact that you are struggling actually is a good sign. It means that your prayers are very effective, and the other side is now kicking up to try to garner some momentum because you are winning on the side of goodness. So that really is a moment of realization for us. We have not one soul, we have two souls. And here the Altar Rebbe starts to describe the first soul. The first soul, which is actually our animal soul, which is our natural soul, it's the first soul that we come to know. It's the one that we're born with. It's the one that the Torah talks about when it says, Yetzer lev ha'adam ra min urav, that the inclination of man is evil from youth. And the Talmud explains, Misha nin ar latzeis, as soon as the baby starts to like, to shake or to move around in order to leave the womb, already there is that evil inclination. And that's the first soul that we're visiting now. We're on page 10. We started to look at the teaching of Rabbi Chaim Vital that every single Jewish person, whether they're righteous or wicked, has two souls. One of them is from the side of Klipa and Sitra Achor. That's where we got up to. Shehen Shtei Nefashes. These are two nefashot, two souls and life forces. Nefesh Achas Mitzad HaKlipa V'Sitra Achora. One soul originates in the Klipa and Sitra Achora. Klipa means a shell or a peel. God created forces which conceal the godly life force found in all creation, as a peel covers and conceals a fruit. Sitra Achra means the other side, the side of creation that is the antithesis of holiness and purity. So we often use both of these terms for the same thing, but actually these two terms tell us two different things about the forces of impurity. First of all, we're calling it Klipa, which Klipa means a shell. And the Alter Rebbe in a Hasidic discourse says like this. He defines klipa and he says, "Kimay sheha klipa mechasa umasteres al hapri, shenir eis kimay shehu ikar hapri." Just as the peel covers and conceals the fruit until it appears as if it is the essence of the fruit. So you come as an alien to planet Earth and you see a tangerine. If you have no experience with tangerines, you think that the peel is the fruit. That's what klipa means. You look at the peel and you think, hey, this is it. The essence of it is this. No, it just covers over something. That's what klipa is. Everything is divine. And klipa is this husk that will have us believe that it is the actual thing. And in fact, if you look at the world today, it's all about PR, right? PR is just the packaging. It's all in the packaging. And the year of the packaging, what was it? It was nothing. You know, those games you play in camp and everybody's trying to get that big present and then they unwrap it. It's just full of toilet paper. You know, it's just klipa. It's Gadi Polak. I quote his children's comics books a lot. He has this guy, Robert. He's the big bad guy. He's like muscular and he's dressed in like a white fancy suit and he has everybody chasing after him. So he's running. He has this guy, Robert, running down the block and he says, guess what I have in my right hand? And everybody's running after him. Run until they get to the end of the block. And he opens up his white gloved hand and he says, ta-da, nothing. And then he says, now guess what I have in my left hand? And again, they all go running after him. Why? They look crazy. But we do that all the time. We're running after the klipa, which is just the facade, which we're confused, and we think that this is it. The other term that we have is sitra achra, which means the other side. And as the Alter writes in chapter 6 in Tanya, he describes, what does it mean, sitra achra? Shezehu perush l'shein sitra achra. Perush tzad acher, she'enai tzad hakadusha. And this is the meaning of the term sitra achra, literally the other side, meaning not the side of holiness. So it's a very interesting way of describing something. You usually don't describe something as the other side. But actually, the sitra achra has no positive name of its own. We can't call it anything. It is nothing. It is just simply the other side. It's either it's holy or it's the other side. And in fact, that is the view of Kabbalah, where if you are not in favor, you're necessarily against. There's no neutral position. Either you're on Hashem's side or it's the other side. And that's also our struggle in figuring out what's the Beinoni. We can't figure out the Beinoni because the second someone sins, he's already on the other side. So where are you the middle person? And that's what we're figuring out here in Tanya. So these two terms, sitra achra and klipa, are two terms to talk about the same thing. When we talk about sitra achra, we're just saying a certain force of reality that is really diametrically opposed to holiness. But it doesn't tell us about the relationship between the other side and holiness. Klipa tells us the relationship between them. What's the dynamic? It's appeal. It's something that hides it. It sees the world in a concentric model where inside of everything there's holiness. And if we are only going to break through the peel, we're going to get to the holiness. So this is where our first soul stems from. Our animal soul, our vitalizing soul. It comes from the klipa and the sitra achra. I have the story from a while ago. I was walking into the living room and I hear a cute little voice saying, "See that animal? She talks." So I look around and they're sitting behind the child safety gate, my 4-year-old and my 7-month-old, and they're looking at me. And he's like, "We're at the zoo." You know, they're sitting behind the bars. And I'm telling him about the animals. And of course, I was the talking animal that walked into the living room. And it's like, wow, actually, that's very, very true. Because from a certain perspective, we're really just a member of the zoo. And that's from the perspective of our vitalizing soul. We're more sophisticated than the other animals, but from this perspective, we're really just about self-preservation. It's the world of klipa, where the world of klipa is really revolves around the ego. The ego is the axis and everything else revolves around that. So that is our first soul, the soul that we come to know first, the one that we're born with, the one that we're relating to, the one that we say, "I'm hungry, I'm tired, I'm mad, I. That is the soul of klipa that we're talking about. V'hi ha-mislabeshes b'dam ha-adam l'hachayes ha-guf. It is this nefesh, which originates in the klipa and sitra achra, that is clothed in the blood of a human being, giving life to the body. U'chidechsiv ki nefesh ha-basar b'adam hi. As it is written, for the nefesh of the flesh, meaning the nefesh that sustains physical and corporeal life, is in the blood. So we have this soul that originates in the klipa and the sitra achra. And where does it find itself home in our body? In our blood. And it is the soul that gives our body life. So we have a lot to unpack here. First of all, let's talk about the term clothed within, because you're going to find that a lot in works of Kabbalah. We'll find it throughout the Tanya. What is this term clothing? So clothing means, right away when you say that one thing is clothed in the other, there is an intrinsic relationship between them. In order for somebody to wear clothes, the clothing has to fit them. So it means that these are two things that relate to each other. And also there is a relationship where the light contracts to the vessel, and the vessel in turn is able to absorb and receive the light. For instance, our power of vision is clothed within our eye. That means that it is able to suit itself to be within the eye. The eye, on the other hand, has the perfect temperament and qualities in order to express the power of vision that is clothed within it. So there is this relationship between the light, the power, and the vessel, the thing that channels, holds it, and also here comes the other thing with clothing, conceals it. because clothing is very interesting in that it reveals and conceals at the same time. In order to reveal yourself to other people, you need to be wearing clothing. And furthermore, the clothing that you wear tells us about you. For example, just if it's cold, I can tell that it's cold. Somebody's wearing a coat. At least they are cold. Or if they're dressed for a fancy occasion, I know that there's something about them. And of course, the style of their clothing tells me something about them. So clothing is revealing, and at the same time, of course, it's concealing. It shows and it also hides. That's actual physical clothing, but let's look in our spiritual experience. Where do we find this example of clothing? Our thoughts clothe themselves in our words. So speech reveals, and at the same time, it conceals. It will tell you some things, it will not tell you other things, and also you will not grasp the essence of the thought, but you can grasp the clothing of the thought. And you can relate to the other person by their clothing. They're sharing their thoughts with you through the medium of speech, which clothes their thoughts. And because they've clothed their thought in speech, you are able to relate to the other person. So now we're looking at this vital soul, which gives life to the body and clothes itself specifically in our blood. The Torah says, "Ki nefesh habasar badamhi," that the soul of the flesh is within the blood. And blood is the perfect medium to contain the soul because while it's physical, it also has something very spiritual about it, the warmth. Warmth is something that you can feel, but you can't actually grasp. It's a spiritual essence within the physical. And that's where our vital soul is clothed. So the blood now circulates throughout the body and gives our body life. It envelops the animal soul, the vitalizing soul, which means that it hides it at the same time that it reveals it. And that's what's going on with us. So we have this vitalizing soul that originates in the Klipa and Sitra Achra. It's a spiritual force that vivifies our body and clothes itself in our blood. And that's very important to distinguish when we say spiritual force, because a lot of times people think of spirituality as holy. Spiritual doesn't mean holy. Spiritual means that which cannot be grasped with our five senses. There's holy spirituality. There's profane spirituality. This is a spiritual force that is not holy. It's the klipa. It clothes itself in our blood in order to give our body life. Now, let's look at the fabric of the soul. From this nefesh stem all the evil characteristics deriving from the four evil elements within it. Just as the four physical elements of fire, air, water, and earth are the foundation of all physical entities, so too is this nefesh comprised of four corresponding spiritual elements. Since they derive from klipa and evil, they themselves are evil, and from them, in turn, one's evil characteristics come into being. So this soul, the fabric of this soul, are the four evil elements, which people talk about it since generations ago, and it's something you'll find in the Midrash and the Zohar. The four elements, the fire, water, air, earth that we know of, are not this. These are the physical manifestations of something spiritual that propels them, that stands behind them. What are they in today's modern terminology? Rabbi Steinzel springs from a letter of the Rebbe that they could be positive, negative, matter, and antimatter. I'm not familiar. I'm just telling this to you so that you know. But whatever they are, there are four fundamental properties that are the makeup and the composition of everything. Now the Alter Rebbe is going to describe these four elements that comprise the animal soul, the four spiritual elements, and he'll tell us what kind of traits come from that. Dehainu, ka'as v'gaiva misayid ha'esh shenigba l'mayla. Namely, anger and pride emanate from the element of fire, which rises upward. Once ignited by anger and pride, a man, like fire, soars aloft. Pride is the state of considering oneself superior to others. Anger, too, is an offshoot of pride. Would a person not be proud, he would not be angered when someone defied his will. So now we're looking at fire. Fire has this property of rising upward. What does it generate in the human soul? It generates anger and pride. And what's so interesting about anger and pride is that they, like fire, fan themselves. They ignite themselves in a certain spark, and it can just get larger and larger and out of control. And Rabbi Steinsaltz points out that when you say in Hebrew, I am angry, or you say, who mitrages, he is angering his own self. It's a reflexive form. The angrier you get, the more you anger yourself. You know, people say like, scream, let it out. Don't scream. You're not letting it out. You're letting it in. You're getting angrier and angrier and angrier. Anger fans anger. And the other thing is mitga'eh. He prides his own self. It's reflexive. You're proud, you become prouder still. These aren't the things that the more you feed them, then they start going away. No, the more you feed them, the more they grow. In fact, Rambam, in Hilchos Deos, the laws of character development, talks about the middle path. So sometimes people have an imbalance, right? So if they're all the way to one extreme, he advises, go to the other extreme, and after you've practiced being at the other extreme, then come back to the middle. Like if somebody is extremely stingy, they should be overly generous, and then they can come back to the middle of being moderately generous. But he said there are some traits where the middle path isn't good enough, where you really have to be on one extreme. And he points out these two traits, anger and pride. And he says like this, among these is arrogance. He's talking about the traits where you just can't be at the middle path. If a man is only humble, he's not following a good path. Rather, he must hold himself lowly and his spirit very unassuming. That's why the Torah describes Moshe Rabbeinu, our teacher Moses, as anav me'od, very humble. And not simply humble. Humble on its own isn't good enough. Therefore, our sages have directed, ma'id, ma'id, have a shval ruach, hold yourself very, very lowly. They also declared whoever is arrogant is as if he denied God's presence, as implied by the Torah. V'ram levavcha v'shachachta es Hashem lokecha. Your heart will be haughty and you will forget Hashem, your Lord. So if somebody is proud, they forget about Hashem. There's no such thing as being a little bit humble. No, actually, when it comes to pride, you have to be very, very humble. And then he says, anger is also an exceptionally bad quality. It is fitting and proper that one move away from it and adopt the opposite extreme. He should school himself not to become angry, even when it is fitting to be angry. So when is it fitting to be angry? He said, if you're training your children and you need to let them know that this isn't the way, so then you put on a front as if you're angry. But inside you should feel calm. He said, he should be like one who acts out the part of an angry man in his wrath, but he himself is not angry. The early sages said, anyone who becomes angry is like one who worships idols. They also said, whoever becomes angry, if he's a wise man, his wisdom leaves him. If he's a prophet, his prophecy leaves him. But, and he says like this, Uva'ale ka'as ein chayehim chayim. The life of the angry person is not a true life. So we're looking at this power of fire in the soul. The evil power of fire, the one that comes from the four evil elements. What does it generate? It generates pride and anger. Pride and anger, they are traits that rise upward. And in fact, they're very much connected, because if somebody isn't egotistical, then they don't get angry. But why do we get angry? Because we're like, I don't deserve this, or you shouldn't act and have that way to me. This element of fire creates anger and it creates pride. Now we're looking at the element of water. V'tavas hatanugim misoid hamayim ki hamayim matzmichim kol mine tainug. The appetite for pleasures emanates from the element of water, for water promotes the growth of all kinds of pleasurable things. The ability of water to make pleasurable things grow indicates that concealed within it is the element of pleasure. Thus, the appetite for pleasure derives from the element of water. So because water gives life to all growing plants and vegetation, obviously, it has the element of pleasure within it. Its essence is pleasure. And people say, like, you know, they sit by the water and they feel like a certain sense of pleasure. That's water. Water is the essence of pleasure. And in the evil place, it's somebody who seeks pleasure just for pleasure's sake, without any intent for Hashem, just pleasure for the sake of pleasure. And it was funny because at class last night, people are saying, you know, can we say that certain cultures are like dominated by one element or the other? Like, she felt like people in South America are dominated by air, which we'll get to. And she felt like America is dominated by pleasure. And she felt like it was just an interesting thing. And I don't know if it's true, but you do see that certain cultures tend towards a specific element, even though we have all four. So it's not like somebody's like, oh yeah, I'm a fire person, so I have fire. No, we tend to have traits from all four categories. And these are what is called as though the avot, which are like the fathers, the principal the principal traits, and then if there's the toldot, which are the offsprings, you'll find something in this negative trait. Well, you can trace it up to one or two of these basic four traits. We have it too in damages, the laws of damages. There's like the four basic sources of damage. There's the ox and the pit and the fire and the mav'eh, which what it means is up for discussion. And there's a great joke of a father who decides his son is brilliant, and even though his class is learning Mishnah, this kid is ready for learning Talmud. So he brings his child prodigy to the Talmud teacher, who isn't quite sure that the kid is up for learning Talmud. And he asks the kid, let me test you on Mishnah. How many primary sources of damages are there? And the kid says, right away, what are they? Four. What are they? And he starts to say, the ox, the pit. And he says, okay, great. Now, what happens if the ox dies? How many sources of damage are there? And the kid says, three. So the teacher says, sorry. He's not ready to learn the Talmud. This is not an ox. This is a primary source of damage, and any ox will be traced up to that ox. And here too, these are four primary sources of all evil traits. Any trait that we have could be sourced up to these one of these four. So we talked about fire, we talked about water, which interestingly enough, I saw in the writings of the previous Rebbe that although the animal soul has all four, the essence of the animal soul is about pleasure. And we'll uncover that when we get to chapter 9. But what that means is that if we transform the animal soul's idea of pleasure so that it understands that the truest pleasure is Hashem, that is the essential way of transforming the animal soul, through getting it to understand that the essence of pleasure really is Hashem. Okay, now we're looking at air. Frivolity and scoffing, boasting and idle talk emanate from the element of air. Like air, they lack substance. So here is someone who's just talking empty talk, and you look at a balloon, right? It looks very big, but then you pop it, nothing inside. That's what air is. There's no substance to it. And here you'll see the difference between boasting, which comes from air, and arrogance, which comes from fire. It's not the same thing. Somebody could be proud, meaning have a strong element of fire, but not boastful. And somebody could be boastful, which is a strong element of air, but they're not actually proud. This is substanceless. Boasting is just substanceless. Now we're looking at earth. Fa'atzlos fa'atzvos misayit ha'afar. And sloth and melancholy emanate from the element of earth. Earth is characterized by heaviness. A man encumbered by sloth and melancholy likewise senses heaviness of the limbs. So if someone is feeling lazy, then they feel inertia. They feel like, I just don't want to get anything done. There's a lack of motivation. If someone is feeling sad, then they shut down. They don't feel that motivation to be active, to be productive. And this all relates to earth, which just pulls somebody down. So now we talked about this soul that is clothed within the body to give the body life. And from this soul comes all the negative character traits that we have. But now there's going to be something really interesting, something that we wouldn't have expected. V'gam mideis taivais shebateva kol Yisrael betol daisam k'may rachamanos ugmilas chasadim ba'ais mimena. From this soul stems also the good traits inherent in every Jew's character, such as compassion and benevolence. So here we see that this soul, although it is a soul that gives us our negative character traits, also gives us these positive character traits. And it's not because it's coming from the side of holiness, but it's because it comes from klipas nega, this klipa that we're talking about. Because, you know, we look at, when we talk about teachings of Jewish mysticism, we say Maisa Merkava, the design of the divine chariot. And this is sourced in the vision of Yechezkel. This was originally very elite. Most people were not allowed to study about that years and years ago. And as we come closer to the times of Mashiach, it becomes more and more available. And in fact, this is what we're studying here today, Maisa Merkava, the design of the divine chariot. And over there in Yechezkel's vision, he describes Ruach Sa'ara, Anan Gadol Ve'esh Mislakachas, a storm wind, a great cloud, and a flaming fire. Those three represent the three completely impure klipot that cannot be rectified, which we're going to talk about. And then it says, v'negalai saviv, and there was a glow about it. This is the fourth klipa, where our soul stems from. It comes from a place that has goodness in it, even though it is the klipa. And so because our soul comes from a place, our animal soul, our vivifying soul, comes from a place that actually has good in it as well, therefore we naturally have positive traits of kindness and benevolence. This is inherent to the Jewish people. It's like a talent. Some family has musical talent, some family have artistic talent. Jewish people have a propensity for kindness. In fact, it's considered the distinguishing mark of the Jewish people. The Talmud says, Shloisha simanim yesh be'umazai, harachamanim, v'habayshanim, v'goymle chasadim. There are three distinguishing marks of this nation, the Jewish people. They are merciful, they are shamefaced, and they perform acts of kindness. This is the distinguishing mark of the Jewish people. And if somebody lacks these qualities of being kind and compassionate, we suspect their Jewish lineage. The Rambam in Hilchos Isuri Bia says, "Kol mi sheyesh be'azos panim ayachzarias v'sayni esabrias v'ein einai gaima lahem chesed chayshashin lei biyaser shema givainihu." Whenever a person is characterized by insolence and cruelty, hating people, not showing kindness to them, we seriously suspect that he is a givaini, a certain kind of non-Jew that came to live in Israel. They tricked Yehoshua. They were really the Canaanim, but they said they weren't the Canaanim, and he made a peace treaty with them, and he honored it. A very crazy story. Later on, they ended up slaying 7 of Shaul HaMelech's descendants. They were cruel, and therefore, King David said they will never marry into the Jewish people. So they can't convert and marry into us because they have these traits that are antithetical to Judaism. They have these traits of cruelty, of brazenness, and it's against our makeup. Our genetic makeup is that we're kind and we're compassionate. If somebody notices someone is cruel and they're insolent and they hate people, we think something up with the lineage. It can't be. Jewish people inherently, by our animal soul, not by our divine soul, by our animal soul, we're kind and we're compassionate.
What was the third thing you said?
The third thing was shamefaced. And the Alter Rebbe doesn't say it here, and I'll talk about that in a second.
What were they called?
Givainim. Yeah, Givonim.
Where are they from? Who are
they? They were Canaanites. Oh, who are they descendants? Their children now? Like we don't know who their children are.
I think you said last night.
So anyway, we were looking at this trait of the Jewish people to be kind and compassionate. And Jill pointed out that the Alter Rebbe doesn't say shamefaced, even though the Talmud says shamefaced. And that's because the Talmud says that the Jewish people are actually a brazen nation. The Torah says, Ki am kshei ayref hu, that the Jewish people are stiff-necked people, we're brazen. But at Matan Torah, we became meek. So anybody who is a brazen person, we say, well, where did he come from? Obviously, his forefathers didn't stand at Har Sinai, which means that they're not Jewish. It's another way of saying it. But when did we become shamefaced? At Matan Torah. So originally, Jewish people were always kind and compassionate. But the shamefaced component came to us later at Matan Torah. Ki b'Yisrael nefesh zay deklipa himi klipas neiga sheyesh ba gam kein taiv. For in the case of a Jew, this soul of klipa is derived from the klipa called noga, which also contains good. And the good within this nefesh gives rise to these positive natural traits. So of course, our divine soul has compassion and kindness, but the compassion and the kindness of the animal soul we don't have to work for. When it comes to the traits of our divine soul, in order to uncover them, we have to work. Doesn't feel fun, like, why should I have to work? I have a divine soul. Not only do I have a divine soul, but my divine soul really, really is my essence. And yet, to reveal my essence, I have to work hard. This we don't have to work hard for. It's literally a Jewish talent. It's a Jewish makeup. It's our nature. Kindness and benevolence is part of the Jewish DNA. We don't have to work hard to uncover it. It's there. Now, of course, when a person acts kindly and compassionately, when they act on it, that's already them working hard. But just these traits towards kindness and compassion, that is specifically a Jewish trait, and it comes from our animal soul where we don't even have to work hard for it. Which is very interesting because our animal soul is our natural self. And we don't have to work hard to relate to our natural self. Our divine soul is our truest self. And even though it's our truest self, we have to work harder to access it. So we should never identify ourselves by our easier self. You should say, well, this is because what's easy for me, so that's who I am. That's not true. It's what's natural to you That's what's easier for you, but it's not your essential self. Your essential self is going to take you work till you're able to access that. So we're looking at this soul of the klipa that is enclosed in the blood of the Jewish person. It gives them their evil characteristics, and it even gives them positive qualities. Wait, how could it give us positive qualities when it comes from the klipa? Oh, because you know which klipa it comes from? It comes from klipat noga, the glowing klipa. This is the klipa that has goodness in it. V'hi misayid et hadas toi vara. This klipa is from the esoteric tree of knowledge, which is comprised of good and evil. It's that enigmatic tree, the one that Adam ate from, that he never should have eaten from. Until then, there were clear boundaries between good and evil. Once he ingested from that tree, then they became intermingled. And there became as though an intermediate state where now they can be intertwined, and it's our job to extract the good from the evil. So this tree of knowledge of good and evil is really the paradigm for Klipat Noga. And it is the source of the energy flow of everything that comes from its domain. And most things come from the domain of Klipat Noga. You look at the table, you'll see flowers and cups and bowls. All these things come from the Klipat Noga. What's the difference between Klipat Noga and all other Klipas? Is that Klipat Noga can and must be rectified. So when we take a drink of water and we make a bracha and we use the energy to serve Hashem, we have now taken from Klipat Noga and elevated it to holiness. But if somebody takes a flower and uses it not for the purpose of Hashem, then they have degraded it from being a neutral, so to say, klipa, which is not neutral because there's no such thing as neutral. And in fact, it's like that with people too, by the way. I once heard, like, if you stand next to someone in the elevator, right, you're never getting neutral energy. There's no such thing as neutral energy coming from another human being. Either you're feeling positive vibes or you're feeling negative vibes. But a person standing next to you in the elevator is never neutral. And that's really what it is with the world at large. It's never neutral. It's either in favor of Hashem or it finds itself on the other side. But within the other side, there are two categories. There's the category that we just talked about, Klipat Noga, which is the glowing klipa, which has goodness in it, which doesn't completely hide the good, and that we need to elevate and rectify and bring it up to holiness. But then there are those three completely impure klipot, which completely hide the goodness in it, and it's as if they have no good at all. And that, for the only way we engage in that is by not engaging in it. By leaving it alone, that's the only way that we can elevate it. And then there's, of course, the devious path, which we'll talk about. So now we find out something really interesting, because there is this soul that comes from the klipa and the sitra achra. What is its job? First of all, it vivifies the body. It's the one that animates our body and gives us life. Second of all, it is the source of all our negative character traits. And third of all, it even has good qualities within it. And here we come to a foundational idea in Hasidic teachings. We're not just saying that this soul of klipa generates our negative qualities. We're also saying, and more importantly, we're saying, this negative soul of klipa generates our regular everyday being. Eating, sleeping, drinking, just being human, that already comes from the side of klipa because it doesn't naturally expose its divine essence. And our job, we want to be human beings that are channels for the divine. So you think, okay, I'm going to rectify my character traits. Let's go into the character of fire. Let's go into air. Let's go into water. Let's go into earth. I'm going to take all those. I'm going to elevate it. Yeah, but you know where you need to start from? Start from the regular physical life vitality that you have. Eating, drinking, sleeping, going about your everyday life that you think of just, this is life. This is actually, without having been rectified, it's klipa. Let's take our regular, mundane, everyday life, the things that we do, just, that's what the Alter Rebbe says in chapter 7. This klipa is literally the needs of the body, and its upkeep, and its life force. You think like, what could be klipa about that? It's just life. Yeah, because if it does not expose its divine essence, that already means klipa. Klipa means shell. Klipa means it's hiding. So our way of connecting with Hashem is not just about refining our character traits. It's going deeper than that, and it's taking our regular everyday living and exposing and channeling Hashem in all of that. Okay, so we talked about the kindness that the Jewish people have. But of course, we're going to have a question and say, hey, I've seen non-Jewish people do kindness. What about that? Isn't it the same thing? And the author was going to say, no, it's not the same thing. And by the way, this turns out to be a very controversial part of Tanya, where people are like, one second, how could you say that? I think nowadays people are less resistant to the idea. And of course, the point of the idea is not to denigrate non-Jews. It's just to give us background so we understand our own makeup and our own essence. And it's important for us to realize we're not the same as everyone else. We're not the same as everyone else. Generally speaking, most of humanity revolves around the klipa axis where it's all about me. Now, if there could be to a very overt way where really the person is doing it just because I want honor and I want fame, I want something in exchange, I really don't care about the other. And then there could be a much more refined way where I can't stand seeing another person suffer. And so I feed him so I don't feel uncomfortable seeing him suffer. That's a much more refined place of being self-serving, but at the end of the day, it's still self-serving. Let's look and see what the Alter Rebbe says. Ma she'en kein, nafshais umais ha'aylam, hein mishar klipais tmeis she'en bahen toiv klal. The souls of the nations of the world, however, emanating from the other unclean klipot, contain no good whatsoever. As it is written in Eitz Chaim, Portal 49, Chapter 3, that all the good that the nations do is done out of selfish motives. Since their nefesh emanates from the klipot, which contain no good, it follows that any good done by them is for selfish motives. And of course, when we say no good, there is no such thing as anything that has no good, because how does everything exist, right? It's a spark of the divine, which is the essence of good. Nothing exists without a spark of good. If you say that there's no good, you've effectively canceled it out of existence. You know, we have this cancel culture. If you say there's no good, it's canceled. It doesn't exist. There's no such thing that contains no good. But when we say no good, it means the good cannot be extracted from it. Like Rabbi Steinholz gives an example of aluminum. Aluminum is one of the most needed materials in the industry. But you can't get it from anywhere. Even though any sample of earth pretty much that you'll pick up will have aluminum, you cannot extract the aluminum from any piece of earth. You need to mine it from specific mines and get bauxite and do a quick chemical process. It's not extractable from everything. So these three completely unclean klipot that has no good in them whatsoever, there is that good that's in exile within it, but it cannot be extracted. It completely conceals and hides it, and any goodness that they do is for their own selfish motives. Now, of course, there's a student of the Alter Rebbe, Reb Hillel Parasher, writes that there are Chasidei Umais Ha'Elam, the righteous Gentiles who abide by the seven Noahide laws. Their soul derives from Klipat Noga as well, and they have the power to do good just for the sake of good, not because they have a selfish motive. But let's remember, that's not most people. Most people are like any other member of the biological system, which has an agenda for self-preservation. So whenever, you know, animals groom each other, they're kind to each other, but it's all about self-preservation. And that's when it comes to general humanity too. They might do goodness for other people, but there's going to be an agenda. There's always going to be a selfish motive. Not always, because there's going to be the righteous Gentiles. But a person who is not one of the righteous Gentiles, when they do goodness, it is for selfish motives.
Do you think most Jews do that the same?
That's a very good question. So let's say someone gives a huge donation because they wanted the fame, right? I read something very interesting that, let's say a Jewish person had this motive, selfish motives. They wanted it in order for self-glorification. And they helped the other person, but in the end, their fame agenda didn't work out. They didn't become famous for it. They'll still be very happy that they did the goodness. They wouldn't have been like, oh my gosh, I did the good thing for that person, and then I didn't get the fame. They're going to end up being happy that they did the act of kindness.
I would think a Gentile would feel the same way.
I know you would think that way, because how do we relate to other people? We relate to other people through our own lenses. So we think everybody is like us. Now, just because someone does think for self-serving motives, it doesn't make them cruel. It means that they have an agenda. They're normal. They're human. They're doing things for self-preservation. Rabbi Chase Taub tells an amazing story. He was being interviewed on this panel on the radio, different members of clergy members of different religions. And the question was, why should you be a moral person? Why be good? So they started off with a Muslim guy, an imam, and they asked, well, what's the point? Why would I be a moral person? He said, listen, you know, it's uncomfortable. You have to hold yourself in at times. But just remember that the goodness that you do, and you'll feel uncomfortable now, there's a huge paradise waiting for you. So it's worth it, a discomfort of being moral, and eventually you'll get really rewarded for it. He said he didn't know much about Islam, but whatever he knew, it sounded kind of authentic. And then there was this Protestant guy, and he said, well, what's the point of being moral and good? And he said, you know, I was actually just asking myself that question yesterday because I was at a protest and I was thinking, why am I at this protest? And he said, you know, I'm really here because I want to show myself that I'm on the right side of the issue. I want to be able to tell myself at the end of the day, I did the right thing. I'm a good person. And it's the same thing with why be moral. I want to be able to tell myself I'm moral and I'm good. And then there was a Buddhist guy and he said, well, why would you be moral? And he said, you know, there's something called karma and don't incur any debt. And you think you're going to do something in this lifetime, well, you're going to pay for it another lifetime. Not worth it. Don't incur any debt. Okay. And then there was an ethical humanist, which basically is an atheist that goes to a church where they don't pray, but they talk about different things of being ethical and moral. Okay. So why would you be ethical or moral? He said, listen, you do whatever you want. The next guy is going to do whatever he wants and the whole society is going to implode. If you want to live in a normal society, everybody has to be good. So that's why you should be moral and good. He's the last guy to be called up. And meanwhile, he's noticing this common thread in all of their answers. So he decided he's going to kind of quip about it. Now, he's on the radio and he's wearing these headphones. So he wants to telegraph that it's funny. So he said, in other words, your question is, ha ha, what are the selfish motives, ha ha, for being selfless? And he said, that's right, Rabbi, go ahead. And he said, oh my gosh, the joke fell flat. You know, he wanted it to be obvious. He's asking, what are the selfish motives for being selfless, right? That doesn't actually make sense, but it made perfect sense. So he said, oh my gosh, but he made the biggest mistake, what he called, that you never do in comedy. And he said, I'm going to do this again. Maybe they didn't hear me. Maybe I'm on mute. I'm wearing these headphones. He laughed a little more. He's like, so you mean to ask me what are ha 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 the selfish motives for being selfless? Ha ha ha. And the guy was getting so impatient. He said, yes, Rabbi, the Jewish perspective. Go ahead. And he said, I don't remember the conversation after that. I just remember it was a lot of mutual frustration. They didn't understand me. Because the Jewish person does goodness just for the sake of being good. It's the same reason. You can ask me why I feed my kids. I can give you some reasons, but that's not the reason. The reason is just because. Why does a Jewish person do good? Just because. Just because I want to do good. But they couldn't relate to that because that's not their modus operandi. That's not their inherent makeup. They have a different inherent makeup than us. And again, this is not to denigrate non-Jews. It's in order to give us background and understanding. We have a life's mission here, right? The Alter Rebbe is like spelling out the pieces and the players. This is an important piece that we have to know, that our animal soul is different than the animal soul of the rest of humanity. Our animal soul even has a component of good that gives us qualities, or even call them weaknesses, for kindness and for compassion. V'chadeisa b'gemar al pasuk v'chased l'umim chatas shekol tzedaka v'chased sh'umay sa'ilim aysin einan ela l'hisyaher chulei. So the Gemara comments on the verse, the kindness of the nations is sin, that all the charity and kindness done by the nations of the world is only for their self-glorification. When a Jew acts in a benevolent manner, he is motivated mainly out of concern for the welfare of his fellow. The proof of this is that were his fellow Jew not to need his help, this would give him greater pleasure than the gratification derived from his act of kindness. Concerning the nations of the world, however, this is not so. Their motivation is not the welfare of their fellow, rather it stems from a self-serving motive, the desire for self-glorification, a feeling of gratification, and the like. It should be noted that among the nations of the world, there are also to be found those whose souls are derived from Klipat Noga, called the pious ones of the nations of the world, Chasidei Umas Ha'ilam. These righteous individuals are benevolent not out of selfish motives, but out of a genuine concern for their fellow. Now, when the Alter Rebbe was in prison, they interrogated him and about all these premises of Hasidic philosophy, because they felt like he was undermining, based on the libels against him, undermining the Russian authority. And they were very, of course, satisfied with all of his answers. And then the last question that they asked is, why did you write this in the Tanya, that a non-Jew only acts out of self-serving motives? And he didn't answer them. He smiled. And there's two explanations for that smile. One is a spiritual explanation, that they say that Altarba's smile was extremely charismatic, by the way. Like, he would just smile and he would win the world over. But his smile was hamtakas hadidim, sweetening judgments. He did something physical that manifested spiritual kindness, and they backed off. But the other thing is, he basically was saying to them, you saw I answered all your questions very well to your satisfaction. Do you want me also to answer this question that well? I don't think so. Let's just leave it alone. And they left it at that. So this is chapter one. We finished today, and let's do a quick chapter summary. We're looking at this oath that we took before we were born, and obviously encapsulated in this oath is everything that we need to know about life, everything that we need to know in order to fulfill our mission in life. So let's look at it. It was, be a tzaddik, don't be a rasha, and even if the whole world tells you that you are righteous, you are a tzaddik, in your own eyes, you should consider yourself a rasha. Wow, there's a lot to understand here. First of all, this contradicts a Mishnah, which explicitly tells us, don't regard yourself as wicked in your own eyes. And even aside from the Mishnah, just from logic, it doesn't make sense to consider yourself wicked, because if you consider yourself wicked, either you're going to walk around and be depressed, which is not a good thing, because you won't be able to serve Hashem with joy, or if you don't care if you're wicked, decide to turn the other way, then that makes you spiritually negligent. So we'll come to understand this if we look at the five categories that are described throughout the Talmud. There is the tzaddik v'tovlo, the tzaddik and it's good for him, the tzaddik v'ralo, the tzaddik and it's bad for him, the rasha v'tovlo, a rasha and it's good for him, rasha v'ralo, a rasha and it's bad for him, and the benoni, the intermediate man. Now, looking at the intermediate man, it's impossible for us to say that he is half merit and half sins. Because if that was the case, how would have Rabba made such a big mistake and considered himself a benoni when we know that his mouth never ceased from study? Certainly he himself knew that he wasn't half sinful. And aside from the fact, it's basically impossible ever to be a benoni by that standard, because the second anybody sins, they're automatically a rasha. They're considered wicked. And if they do teshuvah, then they're a tzaddik. So where is the benoni in all of this? So obviously, a tzaddik is different than a benoni in a very different way. It isn't about who has more merits than sins, because we have to say that a benoni too has no sins. And in fact, on a behavioral level, he's exactly like the tzaddik. So what makes the benoni different than the tzaddik? And we looked at it and we saw that the tzaddik has no evil inclination. King David said, "Velibi chalal bekirbi, my heart is void within me," because he had slain his evil inclination. A tzaddik is different, and a tzaddik is rare. That's why the Talmud says that Hashem placed them in every single generation. It's not somebody who has more merits than sins, because we know, thank God, tons of people like that. This is somebody who, at a core level, is very different in his makeup. He has no evil inclination. So having that as background, now we're going to understand something incredible. We're looking at the teachings of the Arizal as transcribed by his student, Rabbi Chaim Vital. And we come to discover that every single Jewish person, whether righteous or wicked, has two souls. Not one soul, but two souls. Now we're going to look at the first soul. The first soul is the one that originates in the Klipa and the Sitra Achra. It's the one that vivifies the body, which is clothed in the blood. And it also gives us our negative character traits, which stem from the four evil elements, fire, water, air, and earth. Also surprisingly, from this soul come some good qualities in the Jewish person. Benevolence and compassion, because although the soul comes from the klipa, it comes from klipat noga, the glowing klipa, that has some good in it. It's from the secret of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now let's contrast that with the rest of humanity. The nations of the world, their soul does not come from Klipat Noga. Their soul comes from the three completely impure Klipot that has no overt good in them whatsoever. And therefore, yes, they can do kindness and they can be benevolent and they should be kind and benevolent. But where does that stem from? It stems from self-serving motives. It could be a self-serving motive that's overt and coarse, or it can be a very refined self-serving motive. There are, of course, members of the nations of the world, Hasidi Umayis Ha'ilam, the righteous Gentiles, that their soul stems from Klipat Noga, the glowing Klipa, and they have the ability of doing good just for the sake of good.